Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast with over 6 million unique listeners in 177 countries. This is Jason Henricks, and if you've been to London, or maybe even just seen a movie set there, you've heard the infamous line, mind the gap. Well, today's show is about gaps, the wealth gap, the education gap, the technology gap, and the intersection of all three. We've got a great set of guests, starting with Ryan Falvey, Managing Director of the Financial Venture Studio. Today, they released a study on what's driving fintech trends, available on their Medium page. Then Brett talks with Mark Dowds, Founder and Chief Strategy Officer of Trove. The second half includes Ramona Ortega, founder of My Money Future, and Eric Lugo, Vice Chancellor of the City Colleges of Chicago, in front of a live studio audience as part of the FinTechs Forum. Today's show is brought to you by Novae. What does it take to drive users to the right product in banking? The right conversation, apparently. San Francisco's fintech company Novae is doing so in big numbers with a solution that helps organizations talk to any number of users simultaneously and automatically. Their Digital Capability Framework, or DCF, is an all-digital, customizable solution with contactless and invisible payments, AI, machine learning, and digital currency. They've partnered with Visa, making this solution available on a global scale to provide value to banks, even outside of the app and into the real world. Find them on LinkedIn as we-rnovae, N-O-V-A-E, where they're featuring their CEO, Sergio Arana's latest article titled, I See Your Users and I Raise You Our DCF. Very excited to talk about gaps, starting with Ryan Falvey. Excited to have Ryan Falvey, the founder and managing director of the Financial Venture Studio, a very innovative model looking at how do we, you know, really look at new generation of funding and new models around specifically things that lean towards wellness. Ryan and I got to know each other when he was setting up the Center for Financial Service Innovation Labs effort initially around how do they cultivate more for-profit entities going after this concept of can we improve the financial lives of others and actually make a great business out of it. So Ryan, excited to have you here. Can you maybe start by describing how does the Venture Studio work?
Thanks, Jason. Thrilled to be here as well. So as you mentioned, I used to work with the Center for Financial Services Innovation and help set up the Financial Solutions Lab there. And one of the things we saw in doing that, and I think that they still see, is, you know, there's just a tremendous amount of innovation and vitality and vibrancy in the market kind of across the spectrum in financial services. And, you know, lots of founders at the earliest stages really trying to kind of innovate in this space and come up with new ideas, bring new products to market. And there remains really significant barriers to doing that from, you know, a capital perspective, regulatory and legal issues, you know, helping kind of break through the noise on the media and kind of get the word out about what you're doing. And then, you know, engaging with other partners. I mean, which I think you know better than anybody, perhaps, how difficult that can be to work with incumbents and kind of to bridge that kind of cultural gap between where startups are coming from and kind of the risks and how larger firms view their businesses. And so what we wanted to try to do is bring a lot of the learnings we uncovered in when we were working on the Financial Solutions Lab with CFSI to kind of an earlier stage in the market. So we really want to work with kind of the earliest founders, earliest companies who are starting to put, you know, pen to paper, or, you know, start writing code and start deploying product in the market. And I think that's a little bit earlier, I think, than many other investors are sitting in the market. And what we're trying to do there is bring some of that expertise that you might regularly run into with, you know, something like the lab, which tends us a little bit later, or, you know, a Series A investor, but to a really early stage, couple that with capital and really help a founder understand how to navigate the complexities of this financial service industry in this country. And so we do that through a 6-month program. There's, you know, about 5-6 meetings during that period of time, and we're working really intensively with the founders throughout that program to really work on practical issues they might be facing in their business.
And that's not a resident program, right? That
no,
take
no,
them in cohorts, not. But you kind of, because they're at the earliest stage, you let them kind of live at home or wherever they may be versus the displacement.
Absolutely. And I think especially in this market, you know, it's what's interesting is even the earliest stages, you see teams that are kind of coming together. And we want to leave them be and continue working on what they're doing. You know, we're all kind of based in pretty high cost cities and frankly, like the, you know, these might be great places to raise capital. But you know, you're probably better off working in your home network and building a team that can really jive together. And whether that's in San Francisco or that's in Kansas City, I think that's probably a key cultural thing we really want to help the teams instill.
Got it. So you're about to release, I think today even, your trends in what you saw in the application process. Super curious if you can share, dude, what have you observed in longitudinally over your time in this space? What are you seeing the evolution in the trends of the companies focused here?
Yeah, I'll tell you one thing that's now coming out crystal clear, and I think, you know, Jason, I'm sure you see this too, is we're seeing a real explosion now in the diversity of businesses coming to market. I think a lot of that's led by a number of very relatively easy to use API providers. So there's, you know, Synapse and Camber, who are helping founders really kind of very quickly stand up transaction accounts. Obviously, you have Plaid and Quovo and a lot of the information providers. Between the two of these, you know, you can effectively now kind of launch a fully functioning debit card with plastic cards and essentially transaction accounts here for several $100,000. I started in this business. I was in the US, I was working for Silicon Valley Bank, and we were helping companies to get this functionality. And it was you needed to be pretty established before we would be taking you seriously. This wasn't something that you could pull together a family and friends around and come to the bank and get on our platform. And
we actually spend close to $3 million standing that up with Perk Street in the first place. The everything it took, if you think back to 2008, it's not even like you had AWS as an option that you could readily stand things up on, let alone all of this processing and card issuance and all of that.
Totally. And it is like AWS in the sense of you're allowing somebody to basically pay as they go for development of, go back 15 years ago, you would need a bank license. That's an incredible compression in the cost of starting a business. And so like right now, I think, people are I think somewhat fairly criticized some of these as, just they're all kind of the same product. They have really similar feature sets. Like how many debit cards do we need? But what I think it's allowing the market to do is really start to develop very demographics focused approaches, products that are starting abstract away the transaction account and make that a feature, not the core product, something else. And that I think is very powerful. And I think is probably going to be a big driver of that next wave of fintech innovation.
Well, drill into that a little bit further, because I think this is something, Chris Skinner and I talked about this on the show not that long ago, that digital banking, once upon a time was super innovative, but now is actually not actually pushing the boundary. So I'd love to hear more about how they're abstracting the transaction account, not just putting that digital lipstick on it. So where are you seeing how the transaction account is becoming a feature?
Yeah. So that's, tying this, I know that, part of the theme of this show is really around financial wellness. Tying it kind of back to that. Think about a product that's helping someone save or manage on a really tight budget. And you might have been able to acquire customers with a budgeting app or something that's really helping to manage debt. Like a PFM, like a personal financial management type of product. And those, several years ago were sitting on top of your core transaction account, ingesting data, trying to understand what's happening and giving you recommendations. Well, if you can bring that transaction account directly into that product, you can do a lot more to help that consumer live a financial healthier life. And, you know, both in the near term, you know, day-to-day budgeting, but also in the long term, whether that's planning to really kind of get themselves out of debt, whether that's saving to buy a home, whether that's optimizing their educational expenses. One thing that's really interesting that we're seeing now, which I think is related to this, is a real bifurcation on the consumer side of managing debt and the actual debt. So to kind of drill into that, you know, I have loans, I'm sure you have loans, you're paying those loans and you're paying them to a servicer, and that servicer is working on behalf of the lender. Well, there's a whole host of companies now coming into market that are, that, you know, you might pay a few, like Albert's a great company. This is a financial, one of the CFSI Financial Solutions Lab companies of several years ago, that, you know, you're paying them a couple of dollars a month and they're basically helping you manage your financial life. Tally is probably the furthest along, is kind of doing this for credit cards, where, you know, they're basically kind of moving money between and helping you optimize your credit card spend.
Yep.
We're now seeing businesses like this around mortgages, around student loans, and basically saying, hey, this consumer might be in, you know, almost a near permanent state of debt. So I can come in here and really help them to optimize that and really live a more financially healthy life, just assuming that this exists because no one else is bridging the gap. I mean, that could be an entirely new type of product category that, again, is really enabled by the fact that you're able to get a lot more data about a consumer and you're able to start moving money on behalf of a consumer much more cheaply and much more efficiently than you were able to do several years ago.
Well, one of the points that I love that you're making, you know, is we talk so much about the unbundling, you know, really kicked off by the CB Insights famous infographic through its, you know, what, umpteenth iteration at this point about what's being unbundled. What you're talking about is a rebundling. And the part where it gets really interesting to me and what you described is the human is the point of integration to make those choices before around in my cringing at your statement of near permanent state of debt, but the human deciding which debt and optimizing that is actually pretty clunky and hard. But if you've rebundled that and now you can seamlessly move people, you know, into the right optimized thing for them, that's a pretty powerful tool and can really change some lives.
Absolutely. And I think what's interesting is you really empower a consumer in this way. I think that's maybe not possible before. So, you know, we're actually in this next class of companies. We made an investment in a company called Harvest, which is helping, you know, consumers fight bank fees. There's another company called Cushion out here that's the Omidyar Flourish, the new Omidyar, kind of what used to be the Omidyar Networks kind of fintech group, has spun off, led an investment in. You know, I think they have as much bona fides as anybody when it comes to making investments in financial health and financial wellness products. You know, both of these companies are basically saying, you know, we've created an artifice in this country where the lenders and a lot of the providers are really making it very difficult to optimize their life, whether through just the friction they've created or whether through the, like, a lot of the legal frameworks. So I'm going to start using technology to kind of re-empower a consumer. I think these founders are going about this in a way that's really constructive to the industry, and I think really trying to help consumers get clarity. And I'm not sure that that's something that, you know, banks are opposed to, but I do think that that might be a harbinger of a little bit of a shift in balance and power between a consumer and, you know, the traditional providers when it comes to, you know, living a financial healthier lifestyle.
And for those interested in hearing the Cushion story, I actually was fortunate to interview the CEO, and it is in the Breaking Banks episode on the Live from South by Southwest for anyone who's interested. But it is a great and interesting story. So with just the last few minutes left, you know, you talked about APIs and the AWSs of the world really opening up this, you know, kind of next generation and allowing this bifurcation and really drilling down into new segments. Technologically, you know, what else excites you? Where do you think it's overhyped? You know, are personal blockchains actually going to become a thing? Does that have promise for the future?
Yeah, you know, I don't want to say anything's overhyped. I think, well, I'll tell you what's overhyped. I think to go completely against what I just said. What's overhyped is oftentimes the idea that there's transformational short-term change in financial services. Yeah, I think one of the things that's so interesting about this space is it's just a series of edge cases and kind of these legacy things that hang on forever. And, you know, so when I was at dinner last night, someone was making a point about how we're still carrying around coins in our pockets that are identical, that you know, basically identical to what people were carrying around thousands of years ago. And it like, to, you know, you could say, well, that means we should change it. You can also look at that and say, like, man, some of these things are here for a really, really long time. Like, checks are going to be here for a really long time. Paper currency is here for a long time. Like, credit cards are going to be here for a long time. And what's so interesting now is one of the things that where technology is actually really having a big impact is in just streamlining that complexity and saying, like, yeah, I know you pay 15 different bills. Well, let's just pay one. I know that it's, you know, you want to save and it's really difficult and there's all these different pockets of money that you've set up in these systems, but like we're going to kind of put all that into one kind of bucket to help you deal with this. And I think that is something that, you know, where you do see, you know, applications of AI and machine learning really now, I mean, again, those technologies are becoming cheap enough that you're seeing early stage companies starting to deploy them in some of these parts of the market. They're just really clunky. And you're going into parts of the industry that are just really, you know, for lack of a better word, kind of unsexy. And we see a lot of interesting innovation around treasury management for small businesses, which unless you're a banker, you probably don't even know what that means. But it's a huge business. It's a huge, massive, multi, like hundreds of billions of dollar business that is really works very, very ineffectively. And, or it doesn't work at all. Like there isn't treasury management for small business. And you know what, if you can start compressing a lot more data and making predictions about how a business might operate and what cash they might not need and what can be optimized for, you can start building these products and spaces that don't exist. And I think that's what's really exciting rather than so, in 5 years, we're going to replace fiat currency with digital like that. That just seems crazy to me.
No, absolutely. So if people want to learn more about the trends that you saw in applications or venture studio itself, where can they learn more about that?
The finventurestudio.com, finventurestudio.com is our website. And you'll see a link there to the trends paper and to our, obviously learn more about our program and the companies we're supporting. And, you know, reach out where, you know, we're just getting started. We've been at it for about a year now. And we're really trying to be helpful to founders. So if you're building something in the space, like we want to talk to you.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Ryan, for taking time out of doing that good work to talk to us about what's up. And we'll hopefully be hearing more from you in the not too distant future about some of the successes in your portfolio and future trends you're seeing.
Thanks, Jason. Really excited to be here. Appreciate it.
Okay, so I am here in Old Blighty in London, and we're with Mark Dowds, who is the co-founder and the chief strategy officer of Trove. So, Mark, for those that aren't familiar, please just give us a bit of background on what Trove is as a fintech.
Trove is the world's first on-demand insurance platform. So we enable insurance for all emerging risks. We are working with Waymo, Google's autonomous vehicles. So as an example, so when someone gets into an autonomous vehicle, we turn on insurance, and when they get out, we turn it off. So it's all that episodic type of insurance that we deliver.
Very, very cool. So, you also have looked at different types of insurance. Like one of the problems we have is if you look at, say, home and contents insurance, it's very blurry what's included, what isn't. But you guys can sort of insure anything really, right?
Yeah, exactly. We started with what we refer to single item insurance. So it's if you wanted to insure your bicycle, your laptop, and your watch, you know, we will basically enable that where you can add and remove items and have those for insurance for whatever sort of period of time you want. So sort of protect the things that you care about. So that's really where we started in the company. And to do so, it was really, really complex at the beginning. So the insurance was offering us like 65 pages of documents to read, you know, to insure your laptop. So what we did is what we refer to as atomized that. We broke it all down to the basics, structured it to really simple language, removed policy numbers and everything to ones and zeros. So we truly digitized the entire experience. So yeah, we enable you to insure pretty much anything.
Now, you started in 2012, we were saying just before the interview, but tell me how, you know, what's happened in those 6-7 years since you started? Tell us about the growth path.
Yeah, well, it's been radically evolved as the community, as the world has changed around us. We started, the name Trove was, we started because what we really want to do is create the world's largest database about things that people owned. And then we fell into insurance, really. We saw insurance as an opportunity, but over time, we really ended up being smack bang in the middle of it. So now we are a very transactional platform around that. So the other sort of big involvement in the company is we launched with the single items under our own brand, and then other folks started to come to us. So like major banks, tech companies, retailers said, you know, they wanted to deliver a digital insurance platform or digital insurance products. So we ended up then wrapping up what we had as this virtual insurance company in the cloud, this platform to enable these other partners. So folks who had lots of customers and they knew who they were, we're enabling them to do it. It's a smarter model. I mean, because cost of acquisition of customers, I think you know this one well, Brett, it's an expensive sport. So we still have our business to consumer piece, but we leverage that more for learning. The real revenues of the business come through the partnerships.
It's a very similar model to Move in that respect with our strategy for revenue. So bulk revenue is coming through licensing for us now. Is that the case for you guys?
Yeah, we do. We have licensing, and also we act as a digital broker as well. So we get a percentage of the gross written premium, but we also have a licensing fee on the platform.
Now, tell me about the team. Where are you based? What's the size of the team? What's the team do?
86 people, I believe it is today. The headquarters still California, a little town called Danville, just on the fringe of San Francisco and the East Bay. We have in that office, I would say there's 30-ish probably in there. We've got the majority of our staff are engineers. There's a good chunk of them in Ottawa, a lot in Canada, but they all work remotely, virtual. And we have business development. We've got presence there within, you know, Canada, California, London. We're now building out into Asia and so on as well. But probably 3/4 of the company would touch product, and then there's a few of the rest of us get out there selling and doing the rest of the magic.
So you mentioned Waymo before. I'm very, very interested in how automation will change insurance, particularly in areas like autonomous vehicles. Like, how do you insure an autonomous vehicle when, you know, there's no driver that needs to be insured? So, you know, let's use that as a use case, but how do you think automation is going to change the insurance business over time?
Yeah, the automation side of things, if I stick to fleet and cars, and that's actually connected cars, it's naturally going to change how we move around the world. So we also are partnered with Peugeot. They launched a product called Free to Move in Washington, D.C. It's a subscription model where it's basically, so they've got free floating vehicles, similar to what you would find with those scooters and so on as well. Mm-hmm. For them, what they realized in launching a new product like this, what they didn't know was what was going to be the utilization percentage of those cars. So what we did for them is said, well, we'll give you a baseline fee for when a car is parked. So it's very minimal risk, you know, but whenever the ignition hits on these connected cars, then it hits our servers. And then we turn on a fully comprehensive insurance product for them. And so then it gets turned off, you know, when they get out of the car. So this naturally connects us a lot. Then these episodic moments, or what we would say, to right size the insurance and to pay for what you use rather than from the wastage, or we're also eliminating a lot of the guesswork. And because it's all being processed live and dynamically, we're also able to naturally and live connect if there's accidents or claims that are immediately associated with it. Whereas if it's in a delayed format, the first notification of loss and all the issues that arise, you know, compound over time, the longer it takes, the more expensive it becomes. So by doing all of this live and dynamically, we're able to reduce claims costs, we're able to reduce the insurance costs, we're able to enable people to scale. So for Peugeot, they're really only paying for insurance whenever they're getting paid by one of their customers. So it enables them to scale effectively.
So we've heard rumors about Tesla getting in the insurance game and so forth, but it strikes me that if you're an existing motor vehicle insurer, your underwriting models are about to be sort of blown apart.
Yeah, very much so. It's some of the fear mongering I do on the stage, really, on this one, is that you've got the change of control, which is really you're moving from, you know, human to automation is one of the big ones, but you know, so anything that connected. But you've got a change of behavior. I think in the last decade, it's 40% in the US of 16-year-olds, you know, basically have stopped getting driving license. Mm. So you've got a whole new generation that's emerging and going,
Details driven as well.
Yeah, so they're just deciding, I don't need a car. You've got Lyft who have, you know, they announced this sort of all you can eat package for $200 a month now, so you don't even need to just pay per ride. You know, why would I purchase a car when I've got, you know, I've got to care for it, I've got to do insurance, I've got to wash it, where I can have someone show up and pick me up. And all pretty much every operator, all the manufacturers, whether from Nissan to BMW, are all working on subscription models. So it's going to break down the rental car market. You only actually have Avis who have partnered with Waymo like us on that side of things, because Waymo and some of these subscription models still need environments, still need an infrastructure. So the models of these companies are just going to be transformed.
Great. So just wrapping up, Mark, how do people find out more about Trove?
Trove.com, TROV.com.
And so Trove of data, Trove of insurance, Trove of everything, right?
Yeah, that's where it was. It was the Trove for all the things, but now we've evolved even beyond that. So today we're the Trove of everything.
Mark Dowds, thanks for joining us on Breaking Banks.
Thanks, Brett. Appreciate it.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
The Voice America Live Events Channel is here now to showcase your corporate, individual, or organization's live event. Visit voiceamerica.com/live events to see all of our past live events and find out more. Whether it's a multi-day conference, special speaker, or single-day event, we've got everything to make your event a success. We can do a few hours or a few days. For more information about taking your event to the next level, call Jeff Spinard at 480-294-6417 or email info@voiceamerica.com. Again, that's Jeff Spinard at 480-294-6417 or send us an email to info@voiceamerica.com. Voice America is where you are and where you want to be. Join us around the globe as we broadcast live from some of the most interesting events available. Don't forget to view all our live events, including on-demand access to past events that you may have missed, by visiting voiceamerica.com/live events.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Yes. All right. One of my favorites. We're recording in front of a live studio audience, so the applause and laughter you hear is real. Right? There we go. The live applause. Excited to be talking about a topic that is near and dear to my heart and appears often, is the concept around how do we solve for the underbanked. And two very special guests, Ramona Ortega, founder of My Money Future, a budget and personalized financial advice platform with an emphasis on cultural relevance, and Eric Lugo, executive vice chancellor for institutional advancement at the City College of Chicago. So I'd love, Ramona, let's start with you. What brought you to the table here? Tell us a little bit about your journey into this idea of financial inclusivity and how we're going to leverage technology with the underbanked.
Absolutely. So happy to be here. Glad I made it in from New York to Chicago. I spent about two decades in public-private enterprises, both on the policy side, on the nonprofit side, and foundations. And what I understood to be true was that we needed to make sure that we were connecting with the capital markets, we were connecting with financial solutions to really sort of move the marker to, especially around sort of the wealth gap and the sort of underbanked or sort of those that have been excluded from financial institutions. And so I made that switch into law that led me down a path to eventually to starting My Money, My Future.
And Eric, when you and I met for the first time, you were just exiting banking. How did you end up on the educational side?
So this is like really coming full circle for me. Frankly, my mother went to community college. And when this chancellor reached out to say, hey, I want to help you, I would like you to come help me think about what the future of City Colleges of Chicago could be in a city that I love, it was like a no-brainer. Yes, like I understand the role community colleges play in supporting mobility of families, because I was one of those recipients. And so this for me was just a you know, the job of a lifetime, and a great opportunity to support Chicagoans as we think about building a more inclusive city.
Well, so let's start with the term underbanked gets bandied about all of the time. And so let's put some definitions about how both of you think about what does it mean to be underbanked.
Sure, I'll start off with that because it actually is one of those. I think it's a misnomer. I think most people are actually banked. I think that when we think about the underbanked, what we're talking about are people that don't have a lot of access or are not using or participating in financial services. Almost all of our sort of users on our platform, for example, they have a bank account and they probably have a student loan. So they have some kind of credit card or student loan. So they're not necessarily underbanked, but they're not understanding the sort of the full spectrum of building wealth and sort of asset management.
And that's a really important point, because when we think about underbanked, it's too often we go back to that early definition, the unbanked. We think of people who are purely cash-based, but it's actually very hard to find, especially an American who does not have a student loan and a credit card and some sort of credit card debt, but it's part of the breadth.
And even with immigrant populations, because I think this is often some the sort of the facts like, oh, well, if you're an immigrant, you don't have a bank account. That's actually not true. A lot of banks have opened up bank accounts nowadays to bank the unbanked, those that have zero banking products.
So Eric, how do you think about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great point. It's like how an individual is participating in the kind of banking economy is a really important frame. And how individuals are kind of leveraging tools to make better financial decisions is the other frame for me. So, you know, when we just think about the number of individuals that might be leveraging, you know, cash lenders, right, or payday lenders versus kind of working with a financial services institution to, you know, do more than manage a budget, but you know, be kind of more familiar with financial planning and kind of the ups and downs of whatever their cash flow cycle is, that's a totally different thing, right? And so I would say the reality for many folks is, in a particular environment where you're just making it day to day, you're participating in some way, but the underbanked side is like, how are you strategically engaging to make the most of the resources you have and make strategic decisions about the resources that you want to come?
So in a world where, you know, technology, you know, 84% of the country has a smartphone, so it has some level of access with them at all points to technology, and there's plenty of free access to the internet. Why does the underbanked exist? Because Ramona, your point, you know, it's not like structurally, oh, you're an immigrant, you can't get a bank account. They do have some level of access. So why do we see not just the underbanked as a segment, but as a really significant segment of the population?
Sure. I mean, I think it's sort of the elephant in the room that people don't like to talk about, the racial wealth gap. This is a structural issue that has been persistent over time. And so I think what we're trying, when we talk about those that are underbanked, what we're really talking about is who are those that have been poor historically in this country and how do we catch them up, right? So it was that intergenerational wealth piece, right? Which is mortgages, credit. Why do more people have no credit or very bad credit? Why can't they get, you know, the redlining that's happened? So I think that's really what, at least what we're talking about, is how do we close the wealth gap? And that includes all of those things like being in the formal economy, making sure you have sort of some stability in your paychecks, right? So we have the volatile sort of cash economy. And that's something that I think we're trying to solve for as well. So for me, it's really about looking at the big picture and not just the single vertical of like, you get a bank account and you're sort of somehow miraculously your financial circumstances are going to change.
Well, and Eric, I'd love for you to comment. The concept of racial wealth gap isn't exclusive to financial services. It's also closely tied to education. What are you seeing, since Ramona called out the elephant in the room, you know, what is City Colleges doing to address that? And how do you see this concept of education more broadly playing into financial wellness?
Absolutely. You know, they in many ways go hand in hand. And so, you know, to the audience, we're filming here live at Harold Washington College, one of our seven colleges at City College, which is doing some outstanding work to really focus in on bridging that gap. And in particular, I think where education, you know, becomes critical is ensuring its relevance and adaptiveness to the economic or jobs market. And you know, some might say we've lost sight of that, right, as community college systems and as four-year universities, higher education systems overall. But you're seeing a great adaptation at the moment with a key focus at our institution on apprenticeship and work-based learning as a mechanism that starts when you're with us, that helps you find career opportunities while you're with us that connect to your education long-term. So we've got a couple of amazing partners that are leveraging students to really solve for not only their talent pipeline needs, but also kind of really driving towards how do we bring in more diverse employees into our company and create now new, distinct, better solutions for our customers. Aon and Accenture are two that have really been like leading the way in the form of connecting students to technology opportunities, insurance apprenticeships, human resources apprenticeships. And the types of solutions that bubble up are amazing. Like, we've got students that are in this program that had two part-time jobs, juggling a family and school, moved into an apprenticeship now, making a little bit more than both of those part-time jobs combined, with more time to study and more time to be with family. It just puts that young man who's now a new father in front of his child more consistently, which leads to, you know, these other ripple effects. Not only is there better cash flow in the household, more focus on how do you get to the finish line of your associates and likely transfer into the four-year degree as well. But how do you, you know, stay loyal to the company and move up in that particular company? So this is one way I think, you know, college and education is responding. It's really thinking about the alignment of industry and the opportunities that are created with industry for students while they're in school.
Now, two words you said, the relevance and adaptiveness. I know another industry that struggles with relevance and adaptiveness, cough, cough, for the bankers in the room, right? So let's talk about, I think, that lack of understanding on what it takes to remain relevant and to be adaptive is part of what's given this rise of, I love Matt Harris's phrase, the finsurgents, right, who are coming up and approaching it technologically. Ramona, what do you see? Because you'd think with all of this rise of the fintechs, why aren't some of these problems being solved?
You know, it's almost like we've complicated it so much that we forgot to like remember about the end user, right? And technology, I think, has sort of rapidly grown with AI and blockchain and all of these sort of the shiny balls that make things go faster. But at the end of the day, someone has to use your product. And so I think what we're starting to see finally, and we've always started with that, which is you have a user and then you build a product around that market instead of building a product and going finding market, right? So when we think about product market fit for us, it's about how do we create an experience? Because at the end of the day, finance has not changed radically. You're lending, you're banking, you're investing, right? Or you're insuring someone. Those are old. I mean, they've been around forever. So all we're doing, a fintech is essentially creating a different experience. The problem, I think, in terms of sort of financial inclusion is that it's kind of a one size fits all. Oh, set it and forget it. And then everyone's going to save. If we make it just easy, everyone's going to save. And I don't think that's the problem. I think that people need it needs to be relevant. It needs to speak to them. It needs to speak to their experiences. And then it needs to be wrapped in a marketing sort of operation that really meets them where they're at. And I think that's what we do. And that's our moat, right? That's the differentiator in our business.
We'll drill into that for a second, because it's easy, you know, from my mind, just going to follow the brutally honest side of this is, you know, are we talking simply about, oh, it needs to be in Spanish language and, you know, start from a different point, right? Because that seems simplistic.
Let me stop you there, because that actually is exactly the point.
That's exactly the problem I'm thinking, right? So go for it.
But that's your first inclination is we're like, just translate it into Spanish. First of all, we're in all English. Our market speaks English, and we're going after not a multi like lingual market. We're going after a English speaking market. And I think so for banks, for example, their first intuition is just put it in Spanish and then they're all going
to
come.
Don't forget to change the clip art and the stock art, right? Like you just need to change the color.
It's about authenticity,
right?
And marketing is now becoming a bigger portion of all financial services. I mean, look, if you look at commercials for traditional financial services, you see an older white man walking down the beach. Right. Mm-hmm. Even for women, and Ella Vesta is changing that narrative. Even for women, it's like, that's not my narrative for retirement. Right. And so I think what's happening is that people are understanding that the products are going to essentially be the same. How you market it and how you make it applicable has to be authentic to that user and that user's experience. And we're seeing this. I think financial services is slow to the game, but you're already seeing this in sort of other kinds of commercial products. It's already moving in that direction.
If I could just add, I mean, I think there, the other side of this, and a good friend of mine, I pull this from him a lot, and I've actually started to bring it to my own family. It's, we don't talk about money in the context, like we don't talk about money at our dinner tables, right? And I'll just, I'm not going to label my family as an entire, ethnicity, but in my family, like we rarely talked about money. If we talked about money, it was in the context of not having it, right? Mm-hmm. And needing to figure something out, mm-hmm. not necessarily like, are we doing enough to save for retirement? Or like, we got a little bit here, what can we do with that, right? Like, and I think that's really important. That's a really important side of this, this authenticity, right? It's like, how does the marketing help shape the market to think differently about, the conversation at the dinner table? Or think differently about, the conversation in the store, right? There's something to be said there, no matter the language, right? About how we kind of create these generational influencers through starting conversation. I think marketing, can play a really important and maybe superficial but meaningful role.
And it's not, superficial. I mean, anyone who's running a tech company, engagement, stickiness, and retention. If you don't have that, you don't have a long-term company. And that is what we're building into the product through an authentic experience. So for example, because family is so important, mm-hmm. it is a key factor in our onboarding. We ask them, do you plan on taking care of your parents in the future? Or do you have somebody outside of your family that you are taking care of? And then we're building in that in the platform an ability to have a connection to link accounts with your brothers and or sisters to think about parental family like planning, right? So it's operating from a really understanding your end user.
Well, so I want to draw on some of your experience, Eric, because community college also plays a bridging function for people who go from the undereducated to, like Ramona, part of your story being the first to go to college within the family, part of something that was shared with my family. What have you found from some of the cultural, like things that are ingrained in how they approach that need to change when you talk about changing the approach for a family towards education that we might be able to apply to the concept of financial wellness and financial inclusion?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really important question. I think one of our struggles is the point at which financial aid becomes also financial kind of wellness advising, right? And right now, a student walks in and they're really just thinking about how they're going to pay for, this semester, what's the federal aid loan package, right? How much is free versus how much is the family on the hook for? Is there a scholarship that I can get? And that kind of is the end, right? And then if they take out a loan, they get, some long set of documents that they got to read through that says you're going to have to pay this back for X amount of time. And then, you go into the job market, hopefully, and now you're on the hook for those loans, and there are all kinds of other papers to kind of sift through to figure out, the package of your different. We don't actually, at the point of walking into a college, say, here's the financial plan, right? Here's how to think about the next 4 years worth of college payments and financing and how that will connect to your job outlook, how that might connect to the next 20 years worth of savings and kind of wealth planning and all of these things. And so in some ways, we incentivize the transaction versus instead of kind of creating the process by which a student that in our case, you know, 80% of which are African American and Latino, 75% of whom come from the lowest income quintile in our city. How do we take that moment of making a financial decision about education and turn that in? That's the space that we need to be really like digging our hands into, rolling up our sleeves a bit and saying, okay, so what's the conversation point right here that could be so unique for this individual over the next 2 to 4 years?
Well, I like how you phrase it. The transaction is not when you're signing the truth in lending disclosure, right? It has very long-term ramifications. Close to 20% of retirees are actually still paying for their student loans, right? So it's a transaction that has a really long roll time. And it seems like this is a place technology really should be playing a bigger role. Ramona, what are you seeing, not just in what you're looking at doing, but what technologies, you know, it's easy to say, oh, this is about AI and personalization. Can you go a level deeper on, you know, what are the technologies on the horizon that you think are going to make a big difference here?
Well, I think overall in terms of fintech, we're seeing a lot more integrations. So there's a lot more partnerships and integrations. So on the student loan side, for example, there's a number of companies that are working with employers to say, instead of giving you a match, we're going to help you pay down your student debt, right? So there's some kind of employer benefit in helping to pay off student debt. So we're seeing that, right? I mean, even SoFi is getting into that space around incentivizing employers to help pay down. So that's a big one. And so we're going to see that across the chain, I think, in terms of fintech, which is the partnerships. Then there's the B2B plays around financial education that are sort of SaaS models that are being sold to not only schools, but to government and agencies. I mean, that's a space that we're looking into right now. So I think a lot more of those distribution partnerships is sort of where the key is, I think, in terms of where we're going.
Well, let's continue down that path for a second, because a lot of the really exciting things are actually happening internationally as well that can be faster moving markets. What are you seeing internationally that excites you, and who's getting it right or at least doing it differently that can push our thinking?
Right. I mean, so both Africa and Latin America, as you know, sort of went mobile first. And I think that's their advantage. They skipped over all this legacy that we're really still stuck in some ways, especially in terms of banking. And you know, as a regulator, I get it, but they've been able to skip over that and go directly to mobile in ways that are really transformative to access to credit, to underwriting credit, to immediate sort of access to credit mechanisms. I think even when we think about the sort of payday loans, that has been sort of replaced by a direct mobile to banking system. And so you see that most directly, I think, in Africa, I think in terms of like the quickest turnaround. But Latin America, fintech is the biggest investment right now in Latin America. And remember, it's also a very young generation. It's like 125 million millennials. So they're very young. And I think this is actually another dynamic to keep in mind, especially for Latin American and here as well, as our demographics are changing. Black and Latino families tend to start younger. So the millennials will have younger family units, right? So they're not putting off marriage and kids as like some of their cohorts are. And so that actually creates an opportunity also for insurance, mortgages, lending, all kinds of other financial products that will be needed earlier in life.
Well, can you comment specifically? We were talking last week about what's going on in Brazil. Can you share, you know, that was a market you thought that was a leader?
Well, Brazil is a leader in fintech. I think anybody that's in this space knows that. And I think that because the government has played such a big role in social services in Brazil, I mean, as you know, there's a huge sort of very poor sort of population and demographic. And so what they've been able to do is to really move into the sort of underbanked and also getting this people that are working off the grid, on the grid, through the banking system, through the mobile technology.
Eric, what are you seeing as you think of this crossover? You call it, you know, the education and technology, you know, becoming embedded in where it impacts with wellness. What do you think is most exciting? Because there's a, you know, big rise in ed tech, you know, in the same way.
Yeah, I think it's in a number of ways. It's like, how are we kind of leveraging technology to create more accessible or to make education more accessible, right? And then on the flip side is, you know, how are we using that, you know, similar technology to integrate financial wellness and thinking into the student information system? So, you know, if you're logging into, you know, your course portal or your degree portal, you know, what is the barometer there that also is helping you kind of keep a watchful eye on money in the account, money in your student account? Like, you know, right now, you know, these processes can be very disparate. Like, you know, you've got your classroom here, you've got your bursar's office here, you've got a financial aid line there, and that lack of coordination, that lack of a singular point of contact for the student really makes the journey a bit more difficult. I think that the way technology can really influence, you know, wellness in the education context is not only thinking about, well, what's the thing that helps advise students when they are making financial decisions related to education, but then how does that decision kind of come back up? How does that decision permeate over the course of, you know, your interactions with your particular college or university? And in particular, when you're thinking about, you know, learning management systems, where does it show up there?
You know, it's interesting you could extend that analogy around integration, because so often in our financial lives, we think of them as disparate things, the impact on taking out this loan or a credit card or carrying a balance or how much I'm saving today, whether I'm paying down a loan versus, you know, doing something else. Ramona, where do you see, are there cultural differences in the approach there? Are there generational differences in the approach to understanding the integration?
Yeah, so this is actually the most exciting thing I think about fintech. If early fintech unbundled the banking and features within the banks and different financial products, in some ways we're returning to a rebundling in a better way through APIs, right? So in almost all sort of whether it's banks, credit cards through Plaid or Quovo or any of those, you can now integrate a lot of services. And one of the things that was very important for our users was that finance is already confusing for a lot of people and it's overwhelming, not because it's complicated, but there's a lot of moving pieces. Right. So I got my credit card, my debt, my mortgage, all of these things. What we did on the platform was bring them all in one place. And similar to what you're saying, I think people want a one-stop shop. So the two-sided marketplace allowed us to do that, but really being able to guide people at the moment they're making that decision. And I think that's the most important thing. So really integrating it into their life so that it's not a separate thing to do. Mm-hmm. It is actually part of like, oh, I just had a birthday. I had a kid. I got married. I need insurance. I need to think about a 529 plan. So using those life triggers as a way to engage people and then putting it on a platform in a way that makes it easy and accessible. And I, like I said, I think that API integrations now, we're really moving towards that sort of one-stop shop in a lot of different verticals.
Well, I think that's a great place to end on this idea of, we started with the unbundling. When we look at rebundling, it's not just rebundling your financial life into a single institution. It's bundling the entirety of your life and the impact, not just on life events, but what are the ramifications long-term of education and where does education fit? What's the appropriate level of investment? And, you know, technology is probably the integration layer there. So thank you both for joining us today and look forward to many more conversations.
Thank you.
Great, thank you.
That's all for this week's show. Thanks to all our guests talking about closing gaps. Please do join us in a conversation on Twitter. We always appreciate feedback, questions, comments, suggestions. You, our listeners, are our most important resource in driving what this show is. Hit us up at onbreakingbanks1 on Twitter, or you can always just email us at info@provoke.fm. Do you know why else you should reach out? If you're interested in sponsoring a show or a segment, our sponsors make the show possible and often provide really great content, like our friends at Nuvei. Definitely check them out. Feeling antisocial? That's okay too. If you like the show, just give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform in silence. Still want more? You can download and listen to more than 300 shows from Breaking Banks and our other shows like FinTech 5, Serial Entrepreneur, and Breaking Banks Asia with Simon Spencer, all at provoke.fm. That's it for this week. We'll see you again next week for more Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.